I'm going to continue today with further reflections on the practice of recollection or mindfulness. Yesterday we looked at this passage where the Buddha says, someone who acts in full awareness when going forward and returning, in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away, in full awareness when flexing and extending the limbs. The Buddha introduces a new term here. Full awareness is how it's translated. The term in Pali is sampajanya, complete consciousness, total consciousness, something like that. And in fact, when we use the word mindfulness in English, we're often, I think, referring more to a kind of full awareness or total presence rather than the actual recollection. The Buddha sees the practice of mindfulness as incorporating two elements. First, we recollect the body, the breath, the feelings, whatever it is that we have chosen to focus upon. And having recollected it, we are then able to be fully aware of it. There are two things going on. And we spoke yesterday of this idea of constant returning. We return to the breath because we forget it. And having returned to it, we're then able to be fully aware of it. So the practice of vipassana is in some ways a twofold approach of recollection and awareness, of returning and looking deeply into what is happening. It's not repetition. Repetition suggests that we just keep doing the same thing again and again and again and again and again and again. Like a record that's been stuck in a groove. But to return, to recollect, in English the word recollect implies that we collect ourselves again. To collect something means to bring things together. I go and collect fruit from a tree. I put it in a basket. I've collected it. And so often what happens when we have no particular task to perform, no particular object that's calling for our attention, rather than remaining collected, we become dispersed. You might have noticed this. There's a kind of dispersion is part of forgetting, a drifting off, a breaking up of awareness into different ideas and feelings and fantasies and memories. Everything becomes very dispersed. Recollection is bringing ourselves back together again, recalling, recollecting. And at each time we do this, we allow ourselves an opportunity not just to do exactly what we were doing before, but to try to bring yet another element of depth, of penetration, of inquiry, so that each return is also a return to something that we haven't maybe noticed before. There is a process of deepening, a process of expanding attention. It's a cultivation. This word bhavana, which is sometimes translated as meditation, is a cultivation, a development, a growth, a moving through time, seeking to experience, to notice that much more completely, that much more totally. And then we lose it, we become dispersed, we forget, we recollect, we collect ourselves again, we come back to this moment, and that allows the possibility of being fully aware of something which is completely new, that this moment has never happened before, and it will never happen again. So to acknowledge the unprecedented and the unrepeatable nature of what it is that we're experiencing now. And then we'll get dispersed, we'll forget, we'll recollect, and once again become aware. So the Buddha's not singling out a particular privileged quality, mindfulness, which we kind of slap onto each moment, but rather he's describing a process. He's describing a sequence of actions that we are called upon to return to. But at each return, at least we aspire to experience what is unfolding now at a greater depth, with a greater clarity, a greater perspicacity. Now, as we move through the discourse of the Satipatthana Sutta, the discourse on the establishing of recollection, we move from the body. As we become more established in our awareness of the body, we move to our feelings. As we become more grounded in our feelings, we pay attention to the arising and the passing of mental events, thoughts, emotions, images, and so forth. And once we're grounded in this experience, then we begin to recollect what are called the Dhamma. And I think, although this is sometimes translated rather oddly, I think, as mental objects, I don't see why we can't just stay with the word Dhamma. Because the Dhamma that are mentioned in this text are, in a way, the teachings, the ideas that are that constitute what the Buddha envisions as significant, as worth paying attention to, for the purpose of further understanding, further development, and so on. He starts with the hindrances, and I'm going to look at that tomorrow. And then he talks of the five akanda, the five aggregates. Those of you who are used to Buddhism are probably used to this rather curious term, the panchakanda, which literally means the five heaps. Perhaps we could translate it as the five clusters. And what the five clusters describe are not five things, but they are, as it were, shorthand, a kind of aide de mémoire, a heuristic, a device to locate us within the totality of a given moment. The five khandhas is a way the Buddha's version of Heidegger's In der Welt sein, hyphenated, being in the world. Without that being seen as comprised of separate things, but it is rather a total experience which only conceptually can we divide into bits. Experientially, it is a seamless totality. And that's what I want to look at today. In what sense do these five clusters describe the seamless totality of each moment? The five clusters, for those of you who are not familiar with them, are: the first one is rupa, which means form, materiality, literally. The second is vedana, which means feeling tone or feeling. I'll explain all of these, don't worry. The third is perception. The fourth is called sankhara, which is again difficult to translate. My current preference, as of about a week ago, is inclinations. But it's sometimes translated as formations, volitions, impulses, etc. But let's stick with inclinations, which is my preferred choice of the moment. And the fifth cluster is consciousness. So we have form, feeling, perception, inclinations, and consciousness. Now, at first sight, it seems a little odd that experience is described in these five terms as five kind of pointers to help us orient ourselves within the totality of any moment. But I think if we begin to look at them more carefully, we'll see that what they are describing is in fact a process. They're not arbitrarily chosen out of a hat. There is, I think, quite an important didactic purpose here. Unfortunately, sometimes the five clusters are interpreted as a rather funny way of talking about body and mind, a way of talking about our existence as being corporeal and mental. But I think it's rather important to notice that the Buddha does not use that dualistic language. He rarely uses terms like body and mind. He doesn't start, in other words, with the assumption that human experience is primarily physical and spiritual, or a spiritual experience within a physical body. He doesn't start with that assumption. Instead, he starts with this sense that experience is a complex totality that runs from the object of sensory experience to the experience of consciousness itself. And they're all interconnected. There's not a mind somehow apart from a body looking out at the world and things. But this should become clearer as I try to sketch this sequence of events. And the important point is not in this context to get some precise scholarly understanding of this particular Buddhist doctrine, but rather to use all of these ideas as ways of orienting ourselves in the practice of meditation itself. In other words, it's a pragmatic use of ideas to help us recollect and be fully aware of what is occurring in each moment. So we start with rupa, with materiality, physicality, and this includes, and this is where the English again breaks down. The Buddha's referring here to everything that we see, every color, every shape, every form, both in specific detail as well as in the entire range of objects within a visual field. So when I look out into this space, I see a whole range of colors and shades and shapes, of faces, of objects, all of which are impinging on my awareness of this moment. That's the visual field. Rupa also includes the audio field that Martin spoke of this morning. That whole range of sounds, from the most distant rumbling of the truck on the highway to the chirping of the sparrows and the bulbuls in the trees, to the rattle of the air conditioner, to the sound of my voice, to the rustle of clothing against the carpet, to this strange kind of high-pitched whine in our inner ear. And we are constantly present to this rich array of audio events. And what we see and what we hear are, as we know, the most prominent features of our sensory experience. But of course there is also what we smell, sense, odours. We notice this particularly when we go into the kitchen. But we notice it once we begin to pay attention in much of our experience, if not all of it, that strange kind of quality that the air has when it's humid and hot and sticky. And by cultivating this awareness, we turn our attention to notice these details of experience that so often we just ignore or simply fail to notice whatsoever. And tastes, I mean, here we're obviously talking about eating and drinking, so things that may not be present all the time, but once again, how often do we have a funny taste in our mouths, an aftertaste, a dry, cloying taste, a slight bitterness on the tongue, or whatever it might be. And often we simply cannot find the word to describe some of these curious sensations that are present in our experience. And then the fifth sensory field is that of tactility. The sense of warmth, of coolness, of roughness, of smoothness. Everything that we can touch with our hands, with our fingers. When I run my fingers across this page, when I run my fingers across the texture of this cloth, when I shake another person's hand. In each case, I'm experiencing something distinctive, something unique in a way, a peculiar combination of sensations, which warm, cool, rough, smooth, clammy, sticky, soft, hard. And the Buddha's in a way suggesting that full awareness is one in which we go deeply into each of these fields of our experience. And I think the purpose of this is, again, to make us aware of how limited much of our everyday consciousness is. We get so fixated on particular things. And because we spend so much time in a kind of mental commentary or monologue, planning, remembering, associating, thinking, we often are quite alienated from the immediacy of our tactile, gustatory, olfactory, audial, visual experience. So there's something very much about the practice of full awareness, which is a return to the sensuality of the world, to sense the world, to slow down, to experience our feet as they come into contact with the ground and lift and come back into contact with the ground. We're turning our attention away from our monologue inside our head into a closer, a more intimate encounter with the fields of our sensory world. That's rupa. It does, of course, include the body. We feel our body, we are aware of sensations in the body, we're aware of, let's say at this moment, there'll be a contact of our bottoms with a chair or a cushion. We're aware of the texture of our clothing against our skin. And again, this may seem rather kind of ordinary and boring, but start noticing it. Start just stopping and feeling those things. When we wash the dishes, for example, feel the dishes, feel the water, the elements, water, which is fluidity, heat, solidity, motility. Just keep coming back, returning to, in a way, this rather miraculous thing called contact, touching, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. That's in a way these are the fields within which we live. But these fields of sensory objects are not just neutral facts. As we are aware of them, we're also aware that they are impacting on our organism, on the body, on the mind, whatever we call them. And this brings us to the second of these clusters, and that is the cluster of feeling. World impacts us and is always accompanied by a certain tone, a certain emotional colouring. This is Vedana. It ranges from ecstasy to agony. That the world never appears to us just as a blank, but we feel it. It's agreeable, it's disagreeable, it's somewhere in between. It's pleasant, it's unpleasant. We like it, we dislike it. It registers unavoidably as an emotional tone. I mean, classically, it's pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant. I'm not so sure about that middle one. I think what the Buddha's saying here is that our experience is always coloured by a spectrum of feeling. We can usually locate ourselves somewhere between agony and ecstasy. How are you feeling? How are you? And immediately you can at least know what is meant by that question, even if you can't find the right word to express it. Although normally, of course, we say something polite. I feel fine. Whereas in fact it's probably infinitely more complicated than that. Or we may simply be lying. But that, I think that indicates how experience always is present to us as feeling a certain way. And we can see here, we've already come back to the second of the different practices of recollection. Recollection of the body, recollection of feeling. Feeling is a particularly important thing to notice in this approach. Because feeling, as we'll see, is the basis for our reactivity. But we'll come to that. But not only does the world, when it impacts our senses, feel a certain way, it also makes sense. This is where we come to the third of these clusters, perception. Now this one is a little bit more tricky. Perception. What does that mean? The word in Pali and in Sanskrit is sanya. Nya, the verb bit, means to know something. And sam means something like together, to know together. The Tibetans translated it as duse, which means the knowing that collects, the knowing that gathers. In other words, perception is how we organize experience, how we bring it together, literally, how we experience it as something that has a kind of unity and sense. The word, and this is Husserl again, the world comes to us already laden with meanings. So when I look out in this room, I don't see colours and shapes and patterns. I see walls, I see air conditioners, I see people, I see Leela, I see Carmel. I don't have to look at that shape over there and go, Carmel. Carmel comes to me. I only look there and, oh, it's Carmel. I know that's a door. I don't have to do a rapid computation. What's that thing there? Now, this is tricky to notice because it seems so obvious. But in fact, it's not obvious at all. And a very good way to illustrate this, I find, is by looking at some of the work that's been done in restoring sight to people who were born blind. There's a very good account of this in Oliver Sacks's book, An Anthropologist on Mars. And there he takes a number of cases of people who were born blind, but as adults were able to have operations that gave them sight. Now, common sense tells us that when the bandages are lifted off the eyes after the operation, and the operation has been a success, that when the person opens the eyes, they will see their husband, their wife, their child, all of these things they heard about and have never seen before, and there they are. If Hollywood did this, it would be a very moving, sentimental occasion, and there would be soft violins in the background, and everyone would get very tearful. But unfortunately, it's not like that at all. In fact, it is profoundly bewildering. The person opens their eyes and they don't have a clue what's going on. It's just a chaos of shapes and colours. The fact that I know that that's the back of the room and it'll take me about 30 or 40 steps to get there, that whole sense of perspective is not given by the world. It's what I have learnt to organise through my childhood, through my upbringing, through the brain's maturing, so that the world makes sense. There's numerous, I mean, Oliver Sacks has done a lot of work on this. In his first book, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, it's all about this. It's that when you suffer certain aphasias or neurological breakdowns, the world that seems so obvious to us now becomes rather weird and strange. Very weird and strange. So our common sense idea that what we see is what's there is wrong. What we hear is what's out there, it's wrong. We organize, we make sense, we read the world through the faculty of perception. In the Abhidhamma, which are the later scholarly interpretations and definitions of these terms, perception is sometimes defined as the fine discrimination of the mind. The fact that the mind is able to differentiate. In other words, to tell one thing apart from another. And that's also something we can train in. I have a friend who's a radiologist. Now, on a couple of occasions, he's shown me an X-ray. Now, to me, it looks like a rather blurry photograph. But he'll look at it and he'll immediately point to all these different blurs, that bit of grey there, that blodge there, and that means something to him that is obvious. Oh, the person here has a X, a Y. Go for a walk in the countryside with a botanist or an ornithologist, and you begin to realize that your perception of the natural world and the bird life is very crude. That as we learn to differentiate birdsong, as we learn to differentiate flowers, as we learn to differentiate leaves and trees, the world becomes more highly distinctive, highly differentiated. The world is, in a sense, therefore, enriched by language, by ideas, by concepts. They don't get in the way of our experience, is sometimes thought. But perception, which is the consequence both of our growing up, our maturing, but also very much the consequence of our cultural development, of our learning, of our specializations, is all about the refinement of sanya. We learn to organize and make sense of the world with greater precision. And thereby the world becomes more richly differentiated, more rich, more diverse, more complex. Now I find it quite extraordinary in a way that the Buddha, through his own analysis of his experience, came up with these kinds of ideas 2,500 years ago. So just to recap, I'm doing this very briefly, by the way, but just to try to get a picture. We hear that noise, and we all know that it's a plane. It's not just a rumble. It might start out as a rumble, and you say, well, what's that? But we recognize things immediately. We know what they are. A very good example is the written word. Now, when I look at this top word in Hebrew, it looks pretty much like squiggle, 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 squiggle. When you look at it, I presume it means something. But you don't have to think. You don't have to go what those squiggles are. It must be the Hebrew for schedule, I guess. But it's strange. The meaning is already, as it were, jumping off the page. When you see graffiti scrawled on a wall, something very, very rude, some sort of swear word, you see it and you feel shocked, perhaps. You have an immediate, almost emotional reaction. In other words, the meanings are already given. We've learned how to read our world. Now that also refers, of course, to our own inner life. We know how to make sense of that too. We know how to recognize feelings. We know how to recognize emotions and thoughts. We can talk about our inner experience in a coherent way to ourselves and to others. It's intelligible. It's differentiated in a way that makes sense. But that is something that we are bringing to the raw data of experience. It's not something that's coming from the data themselves. So this, I think, is why the Buddha organizes these five clusters in this sequence, because he's talking, first of all, of the immediate sensory given that simultaneously feels a certain way and makes sense in a certain way. But consciousness or experience is not just a passive reception of data. It's also an arena for possible actions. The world comes to us and we respond to it. And the fourth cluster, which is called Sankhara, my preferred choice at the moment being inclinations, we incline towards an action. The world presents itself to us as a place for us to do things. We automatically, spontaneously respond to it. We think about it. We have judgments. We make choices. We cultivate longings, desires, fears, hatreds, all of these qualities of mind that we talk about so often are ways in which we are inclined to respond. The world is a field of potential action in every moment. It calls forth from us a response. And in many ways, the practice of morals, the practice of meditation, is about cultivating what we consider to be an appropriate as opposed to an inappropriate response. The perhaps the primary response is captured in this term cetana, which means intention, volition, decision, choice. And again, in the Abhidhamma, they define this as that which moves the mind to an object. That which moves us to an object. So when a field of experience presents itself to us, we will be inclined to single out one thing rather than another. Particularly if, let's say, there's a big truck coming at us at 100 kilometers an hour, the mind will move to that object quite naturally and get out of the way. If there's something terribly attractive, let's say there's a $100 bill lying on the ground, the chances are the mind will incline to the $100 bill. In other words, experience presents itself to us and then we incline towards it in a certain way. It starts with mental activity, but that can very easily begin to emerge in the form of words, in the form of actions, bodily movements. We engage with the world. Engagement is not an option, really. It's something that the organism is primed to do. We act, we choose, we prefer, we judge, we plan. There's nothing wrong with any of that. It's simply how we comport ourselves in this reality that is present to us, that feels a certain way, that's intelligible, and then we act. Now, what's, I think, quite helpful sometimes in meditation is to spend a few moments just running through these different categories, the material world or the phenomenal world of sounds, smells, tastes, visual forms, how we feel about that, to note how that is present as a physical or a mental sensation, to note also how the world is there as an intelligible sphere of things and persons and objects, and how the mind is constantly inclined to respond to it in a particular way. And it's only then that we come to what we call consciousness. Now, consciousness, in some ways, is the most difficult one to describe. It's not the same as perception. It's our overall field of being aware of what is happening, which includes we are conscious of how we perceive the world. We are conscious of how we feel about the world. We are conscious of the objects that are presented to us in the world. We are conscious of how we are inclined to respond to the world. Consciousness is the whole, that's whole, of these various constituent parts. In other words, consciousness is an emergent property of the interaction between an organism and its environment. I'll repeat that. Consciousness is an emergent property. In other words, it's something that arises out of the encounter between an organism and its environment. Consciousness emerges. Consciousness is an emergent property. It's not something that's somehow lying there in the background waiting for things to happen. It's actually the fruit of billions of years of evolution of this organism in encounter with this world that then gives rise to this extraordinary experience we call consciousness. Consciousness is so close to us, it's very difficult to grasp it. And yet we all know, that we're aware, that we feel, we know what this is, we know what that is. And yet it's not reducible to simply perception or feeling or inclination. It includes the lot. My Tibetan teacher gave a very good analogy for this. He said it's like a hand. The hand is composed of skin and bones and nerves and blood and joints and ligaments and all of this stuff. But the hand is able to do things that none of the individual parts can do by themselves. My hand can pick up the glass of water, but my finger can't do that, my skin can't do that, my bones can't do that, my nerves can't do that. But because of the extraordinary organization of those varying elements, there comes into being what we call a hand. A hand cannot be reduced to any of its bits, but neither can it exist without those bits. I mean, this idea is present in Gestalt psychology. It's basically saying the whole is not equal to the sum of its parts. The whole is somehow more. It transcends the sum of its parts. And consciousness is like the hand, and the parts are like feeling, perception, intention, attention, all of these constituents that make up that whole. So consciousness does not exist as a thing in and of itself. And I think one of the Buddha's great breakthroughs was to recognize that there's no such thing as a unitary or a pure consciousness. consciousness is only intelligible as a function of a complex organism interacting with a complex environment. Now, some of these ideas only came up in Western philosophy about 2,000 years after the Buddha. I mean, some of you are aware that this is very close to certain aspects of phenomenology. The idea also that consciousness cannot exist without an object. It's what Husserl called intentionality. Consciousness is always consciousness of. Now, I've got a passage in this text here. This is from a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, Sutta 38. And this is Sati, the fisherman's son, talking to the Buddha. He says, "As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Buddha, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths, not another. What is that consciousness, Sati? It is that which speaks and feels and experiences here and there as a result of good and bad actions." And the Buddha says, "Misguided man, you fool, you twit. To whom have you ever known me teach the Dhamma in that way? Misguided man, in many discourses have I not stated consciousness to arise upon conditions, since without conditions there is no origination of consciousness? Bhikkhus, monks, consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent upon which it arises. When consciousness arises dependent on the eye and visual forms, we call it eye consciousness. When it arises in dependence upon sounds and an ear, we call it audial consciousness." And so on. In other words, for a start, consciousness is not unitary. It's not just one thing. It's visual, audial, depending upon the particular field of objects in which it is operating. And at the moment I have a visual consciousness of this room and the people in it, if I shut my eyes, that visual consciousness is no longer arising. If I open them, oh, it's there again. Close them, gone. Consciousness only occurs when the particular sets of conditions prevail. In other words, a visual organ, in the case of seeing, the presence of light, bouncing off objects, impacting the eye, the retina, and now, of course, we bring in the brain, sending electric charges to the brain, and then boing, consciousness. It takes about half a second for that to work. So, in fact, everything that we see, hear, smell, taste, touch is actually what happened half a second ago. That's actually quite a long gap. It takes that long for the brain to process that data and for me to say, "Oh, look, I'm in a room again." But that's already half a second late. This has some rather scary implications too, which I won't go into. And then the Buddha gives an analogy. He says, just as fire is reckoned by the particular condition dependent on which it burns, when fire depends on logs, we call it a log fire. When fire depends on grass, we call it a grass fire. When fire depends on something else, we call it a something else fire. In other words, consciousness is simply the consequence of a particular object impacting a particular sense that then gives rise to it. The Buddha also recognizes that there's somehow a kind of interdependence between what we are aware of and our consciousness of it. That consciousness arises out of the complexity of the world, but we're only able to have any sense of the complexity of the world because of consciousness, because we're conscious of it. He seems to recognize that the two somehow go together. You can't have consciousness without this phenomenal world, and a phenomenal world is only present to us because of the sophistication of what we call consciousness. The two are somehow implicated, one with the other. But what I think is clear from this account is that consciousness is simply another element within this open field of events. It's not considered to be more primary, nor is it, strictly speaking, just a mere sort of, epiphenomenon, something that just sort of bounces off the top. It's both. Our experience is somehow wound up with consciousness. It's unintelligible without our being conscious of it. But without the world, there would be no consciousness. It's very difficult. And of course, what we're actually describing is this. The Buddha's trying to put into words something that, in a way, escapes that those rather crude tools. And this, I think, is why it's so important that rather than simply believe or disbelieve in this theory, we need to see it as rather a set of pointers or instructions or suggestions that help us orient ourselves in this experience we're having right now. And what is curious about this experience is it all hangs together. We have data coming from all the different senses. We have data coming from our memory, from our culture, our education, and yet it always appears as a seamless whole. In neuroscience, this is called the binding problem. In other words, they haven't got a clue how their mind does that. And that's what's miraculous in a way, that it is all coherent, at least most of the time. But again, people who have had certain neurological lesions or strokes, their world is bizarrely different. There are holes in it sometimes, or things don't organize themselves in the way that other people organize them. So this experience is also, it's highly complex, it's also highly tentative. It's like, I can't think of the image, it's here now, because we have a functioning organism, because the world is the way it is. And this is the result, what we call consciousness. And we're also conscious of being conscious. Consciousness has a kind of a reflexive quality, is what it's called. We're not only conscious of objects and people, we're also aware that we're aware of them. And if we step back a bit, we're aware that we're aware of being of them. And if we step back a little bit more, we're aware of being aware of being aware of being aware of a plum. At a certain point, the mind, it just gets too complicated. But it's a bit like, you know, when you're in a lift or a bathroom sometimes and you have parallel mirrors and you can see almost to infinity. Reflections of reflections of reflections of reflections of reflections. This is also a curious property of this quality called consciousness, to be conscious of itself, to be self-reflexive. And yet at the same time, as much as I've searched in my meditation, I've never had a direct experience of consciousness. Each time I try to be conscious of consciousness, I end up with the object again. Try it. You may find something different. Some spiritual traditions say that you can arrive at some direct intuition or sense of consciousness itself. I've never managed that. I'm still working on it. Can we do questions later? Because I'm just about to finish, actually. But it seems to me that one of the functions of consciousness is that it's always bound up with the narrative of oneself. That we are conscious of being aware as part of our story that is constantly unfolding about this person, Stephen. If we weren't conscious of being aware, we wouldn't be able to construct that narrative which has memories, which has projections, which has plans, which has purposes and values. It holds the story together. And that, in a very summary way, and I think I forgot to put the recorders on. is what I want to talk about today. Now, I've recorded it on my own one, so you can have a copy. It's no problem.